Good afternoon. You're listening to Gambling with an Edge. Now here are your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Martin Magyar, spelled M-A-G-Y-A-R. He is the author of a new Huntington Press book called The 50 Greatest Stories in Poker History. Martin Magyar, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you for having me.
Your name and your accent hint that you're from Central Europe. What is your ethnic background?
Well, I'm Hungarian. I currently live in Budapest, Hungary, the capital city. But for example, my dad is from a village in East Hungary. When he was born, their home didn't have a bathroom, for example. So, like, in going back a generation, we're kind of a rural Hungarian, East Hungarian family. But I grew up in Budapest, capital city, in a very urban environment, a nice neighborhood. But all I know is Hungarian. Like, I can only trace back my ancestry to Hungary and nothing else. I've been to the U.S. twice. I worked 2 summers there, but as far as genetics ancestry, I think I'm 100% Hungarian.
Okay. This book is about poker. How long ago did you start playing poker?
Well, actually, I was playing back in high school without really thinking about it, without being particularly good at it or studying it, really. I watched some stuff on TV. We got around the same time the moneymaker boom came to Europe. That was a couple years after 2003 when Moneymaker actually won. And we got some Poker After Dark, High Stakes Poker, stuff like that on our sports channel. And I was watching that. I was playing like Play Money online, but never thought about actually doing anything with it until much, much later. I started playing probably on 7th grade, 13, 14, and I got my first job as writing about poker, as a poker writer, when I was 23, and that's when really I started making it a big part of my life. For like a decade, it was just something that I kind of enjoyed. I was looking back now that I spent quite some time studying the actual strategy. I was pretty bad at it, but I still kind of enjoyed it. And I got this job because of my English skills. In Hungary, what you're hearing right now, this issue is pretty good English. So I only got that job because I could write well in English. And then as I was writing, I just kept researching and kept really getting into it. But for like a decade, it was just something that was in the back of my mind, like, oh, I kind of like this game. And then when I was 23, that's when I not just started writing about it as a job, but also I just thought, okay, if I'm going to write about this game, I really want to study it. And, you know, started watching strategy content and got some software and all that.
So you still play, are you an active player today?
Yes, but very low stakes cash mainly. Like 1 cent, 2 cent, 2 cent, 5 cent online. And in Hungary, I play 1500, which sounds good, but it's foreign. So it's like a forint is around, so $1 is worth around 300 forint. So that is like 15 cents, 30 cents at live. And I'm winning at very low stakes, but I don't think, you know, I would make much if I moved up stakes. So I'm comfortable here. Most of my income is creating and managing content for poker site, affiliate site. So I'm kind of content with it, just staying at low stakes.
Which sites do you write for?
SoMuchPoker.com. I'm doing part-time now, content managing. I used to do it full-time. I just had to go back to college to finish my master's. So I had to drop down to part-time. Before that, I was a content manager for VIPGrinders.com. I was freelancing for like PokerClarity.com, which is a coaching site run by Lexi Gavin. I don't know if you know her. She's like a big tournament player and cash player. She was on Poker Night in America, for example. I did some freelance work for her, and these are the most recent ones. Reapricanda.com, so much poker.com, I still work for only part time, and pokerclarity.com. Those are the three most recent ones. As for the biggest one, was High Stakes DB. I did a couple of articles for them as a freelancer too.
Are what you write, how to play hands, such as how to play 5-6 suited if you're in such and such position, or do you write about poker history?
I did some strategy for Poker Clarity, but I mostly wrote poker news, kind of gossipy. Right now I do player bios and sort of country profiles for so much poker.com. I add event when it's just like a database of events, like what is taking place where. I submit to those into this nice laid out database. Also, what else? When I was working for all the other sites, I usually did test, oh, this happened on Poker Twitter, or this feud, or this big score, and all that typical stuff. I did most of my writing was always not strategy, but I did some strategy too.
Now, poker is played all over the world, including Hungary, but it's mostly an American game. Your 50 greatest stories take place in the United States. How did it happen that a book about the 50 greatest U.S. poker stories were chronicled by a European?
Well, the vast majority take place in the U.S., which is, I think, because it's the origin country of the game of poker, and also the biggest poker industry, even after Black Friday, is still in the U.S. But there are some European stories, like I remember one about Annette Oberstad, a Norwegian girl winning the WSOP Europe main event at 19. You know, yes. She's a Norwegian girl, and she played that event in London, but I can't give you an exact number how many is European versus American. I know there are some Hungarian guys in there about the biggest winners online, but it's just the biggest industry. That's where the WSOP is played every year. You know, before Black Friday, the biggest online poker market was in the US, and the real frontier time with the old legends of these gamblers, that also took place in the US. And if you look at the biggest players right now on Hand'em Mob, most of them have American flags next to them. So that's just how the world works. But I've always loved America and American culture. So it's like adopted, not home, because I only spent like 2 summers there, but adopted favorite country, basically, in America. It's always been. So it's not far from me. I'm quite in tune with American culture as much as I could here. And I don't regret it. I loved it. It's mostly US, I think. I don't think that's a problem.
It would be interesting to hear stories about these enormous nosebleed stakes games that are happening in Macau, but I assume it's difficult to get people to talk about what's actually going on in those games.
The closest thing I got in this book is about the rise of short deck hold'em, which originated from there. And there's this origin story. It's probably, you know, just reading it, I don't think it's factual, but the origin story is that there was this rich Asian businessman who was so angry at losing the big pot that he threw out the 2s, 3s, 4s, 5s, and 6s out of anger from the deck. Although it's a hard thing to do, but that's what the origin story is. And then other players just went with it, started playing without the low cards, and eventually they got the 6s back, and that's how short deck hold'em was created, supposedly. I don't think it's a historical account, but there is this larger myth around it, and that game comes from the super high stakes East Asian cash game circle. So there's some of it there too. But again, you know, Tom Dwan likes to play there, Phil Ivey, and actually my bosses at So Much Poker, they're East Asian. like the guy who runs the site, he interviewed Phil Ivey in Macau, so I have a minimal connection that I could ask around. But you know, the one thing I gather is about Showtech Holder.
Yeah, I was in Moscow 20 years ago, and they were playing a short deck poker. I don't remember exactly how the deck was short. I just remember it was short. I didn't play it. I was just watching some of it. But so versions of that have been around for quite a long time.
I actually wasn't aware of that. As far as I knew, it came from East Asia in the somewhere in the mid-2010s, but apparently no. So thank you.
Now, most of your stories are only a few pages long. And most of them I was familiar with, like stories about Wild Bill Hickok or the chip in a chair or Scotty Wynn saying, call this hand and it's all over, baby, or some of the others. I knew the stories. But you added aspects to the stories that I never heard before or had forgotten. How much research did you have to do to create this?
So I started writing this in November 2019, and it came out in October 2021, which is 2 years, but it wasn't like 2 years of intense research. I delivered the first manuscript in April 2021, so about about 6 months after I started writing. And they got back, oh, we like it, but originally it was just 36 stories. So they said, like, this is not enough for a book, so please extend it. And then I submitted the extended manuscript in June 2020. And then we had a bit of a back and forth of, oh, he edited something, the editor at Huntington Press, and then I got back the edited version, and then I edited something. So we had this table tennis with the manuscript for a year. As far as research, it was virtually 100% online. I did get some PDFs of actual printed books, but I never left my bedroom, basically, while researching it. So it was 100% internet-based research. And also, a lot of it comes from stories that I actually reported on as a poker news writer. So I remember some story from like 2-3 years ago, and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Also, what helped a lot that I started writing the biographies of famous poker players for so much poker, and obviously I found so many interesting stories there. That actually, that's what gave me the idea for the book, specifically about the one with Andy Beer versus the corporation. When I found that story, I was like, oh my God, like, this is an actual event. And that just gave me the idea, okay, I could collect stories like that into a book.
Yeah, so the story that interested me the most was the story about Johnny Moss and Nick the Greek supposedly having this massive millions of dollars heads up match. And the story, I grew up on this story. It's one of the stories that first got me kind of hooked on gambling. And the way the story was always told was that they were playing on the main floor at Binion's Horseshoe. And, you know, Benny Binion was a genius because he used this as promotion to get people to come to his casino. And it wasn't until I read Smoking Aces, the biography of Benny Binion, that the idea that maybe this game never happened came forward. I had never heard that idea prior to this. And then your book kind of added one more piece to this, which is Jack Binion apparently at some point responded and said the game actually did take place, but not at the Horseshoe. It happened at the Flamingo, and I gather it was not out in public. But it's I have a number of thoughts about it. I mean, number one, I wonder where this idea that Benny Binion was using this for promotion when it wasn't even at the Horseshoe and wasn't open to the public, like where that story got started. Although a lot of people love to sing the praises of, you know, this sort of murderer thug guy. But and the other thing, once I heard that it happened at the Flamingo in that time period, it made me wonder if Johnny Moss was cheating him because, you know, Nick the Greek supposedly lost millions of dollars and at the end says, Mr. Moss, I have to let you go. But, you know, Doyle Brunson recounted in my book that Johnny Moss was cheating at the Flamingo using a peek and got caught by some mob guys. And he basically had to leave town and not come back for many, many years because he was afraid of getting killed.
So the thing about that, that it's supposed to take place in 1949, and the Binion's Horseshoe wasn't opened yet. It opened in the early 50s. So, you know, right off the bat, it's something fishy right there. And then there's no contemporary media reports, newspapers, articles, anything about those. So, again, like, it should raise questions right away. Because the first time it was even mentioned publicly, this big game was a little after Nick the Greek died, and it was told by Johnny Moss. So it's kind of like how Napoleon Hill started writing his book and talking about his book, Think and Grow Rich, right after Andrew Carnegie died. It's the same thing. It's probably, I still believe, even after reading what Jack Binion, Benny Binion's son, wrote, I think he just unsolicited wrote an email to pokernews.com. I think that's the story there, that, oh, it actually did happen. It just, you know, it just sort of the compilation of multiple stories. I still think the most likely explanation is that Johnny Moss made up a tall tale, probably somewhat based in reality, but mostly fiction. Just to tell a good story, I still believe that. But yeah, right now, what we know from Jack Binion, Benny Binion's son, is that, yeah, it was a private game, and oh, he only got the date and the venue mixed up because he played so much Super High Stakes cash games with these famous guys. But still, after some research that I wrote in this book, I still believe the most likely explanation is that Johnny Moss made up some fun stories. For example, Jack Binion, Benny Binion never acknowledged it. He just said, like, oh, I don't really remember, or my memory isn't what it used to be. I think that was those were the exact words, his response to his supposed story. So that's another piece of information that makes me say, like, it's probably just a Johnny Moss tall tale, which is fine. It's a fun tall tale, but, and Johnny Moss most likely did win millions, I don't know, you know. But
well, especially if he was cheating, I'm sure he won. I mean, and yeah, maybe he exaggerated the amounts or whatever.
A minor correction to what Richard said. The book was not called Smoking Aces. It was called Blood Aces.
Ah, thank you.
The author is Doug Swanson. And he was a guest on Gambling with an Edge several years ago. You can go back and listen to his explanation of this particular story. And when he came out and said he didn't think it was really happened at the time, I was quite surprised.
Yeah, I was too. Martin, have you, in your research, did you find reference to other people thinking it may not have happened prior to that book?
No, I don't think so. But, you know, I kind of heard about this story rather late. So I already, my first introduction to this story was, oh, this is something that's likely not happened. So when I started researching, I researched from this point of view, like, okay, this is a nice little tall tale, and this is a fun little anecdote or half fiction anecdote. So it wasn't like a big shock to me when I came into this opinion that it never happened.
Do you have a favorite story in this collection, Martin?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I like the one about Andy Beard, the corporation, because that's the one that really gave me the idea of to write a whole book about this stuff, because originally I wanted to do like a almost like a historic research about the history of the card game, but I realized that I think this is a better way to present the history of the game, just short little snippets of stories. So because that's what originated the idea, I like that one. I like Mike Parcell's story because that's what one that actually lives through and actually was writing multiple articles as it was happening. So I have a sort of somewhat of a personal connection to that story. And I like the one about Richard Nixon because I have a pretty big fascination with American presidents. And so when I got to combine my love of poker and president, that's always a fun time for me. So these three I would pick.
You know, there's a mythos about presidents always seem to be great poker players, just like, you know, hedge fund guys always are former card counters. And I really wonder, I mean, apparently Nixon did make money during the war, you know, as a poker player. And people claim he was a great poker player. I'm sure by today's standards, he'd be considered awful. But there seems to be a lot of that, right, with poker players. I mean, with presidents.
Yeah, there are quite a few who actually, you know, we know that they did play poker. How well they did, it's a hard question because those games obviously not recorded. Nixon is different because, you know, his biographer wrote about this, him winning thousands of dollars while he was in the Navy stationed near Australia during World War II. He got transferred to some quieter place by WW2 standard. So he was playing five card draw and either five card or seven card stud, I'm not sure which. And it's something similar to what Amalaro Slim did. He did serve overseas and came back rich with pool and poker winnings. It's a smaller version of that what Richard Nixon did, but according to his biographer, he did use some of that poker winnings to fund his first congressional campaign. So he's most likely the one that he actually, studied some strategy probably. What he wrote is he played tight and he didn't really enjoy the game as much as winning money at the game. So he was a rock solid tight player.
Yeah, well, there wasn't much poker literature back then, and what there was basically was play super tight. It wouldn't surprise me if that was his style.
Now, you started out with 36 stories, and Anthony Curtis says, we need some more, so they got up to 50. If you had to go to 60, what other stories do you think you would add?
So they would most likely come from the 2010 and onwards that has a lot of information online, and most of it I lived through as a book writer. Because, when I started writing this, I didn't want to make it so-called top-heavy. I didn't want to do like 30 stories in the 2000s and just 20 in the 1800s and 1900s. I wanted to keep some kind of a balance. But if I had to make it 60, I don't think I had a choice. I would have to go with the 2010s and now 2020s to find good stories. For example, I really like the one about Jean-Robert Ballon playing in a super high stakes cash game in Jeju with Andrew Ropel, who was staking him or backing him. And while his staker is next to him, basically, he does like a 5-bet all in with 5-3 suited and loses half of his profits that he accumulated in hours. And then in very next hand, he gets that aces and, he gets outdrawn by 9. And in like two hands, like hundreds of thousands of dollars in profit is gone. and he's just, you know, has to like go up all his wine, just swallow it very quickly and leave while his backer is right next to him and just fuming and calling him an idiot. I still like that story. I just think about it sometimes and just smile about it.
But yeah, that's a wild story, and it's weird. Like, why was Andrew Roble staking JPB? I mean, that seems weird to me. Like, first of all, I would think JPB could stake himself, and I don't know either of them, but just, you know, what I hear is Andrew Roble may be the better player of the two. I don't know. Just a weird story to me.
Comments said on the video, like, staking Balland is worse than going all in with 5-3 suited. That's what the comments said.
I'm going to be really happy with that if I'm staking a guy and he goes all in with 5-3 suited.
Yeah. Unless it works.
Yeah, but it would still be his last hand playing for me, even if it worked.
I think Andrew Roble understands, like, variance that if you win a whole in part with 5-6 suited, that doesn't make it a good play. I think Andrew Roble understands that. Another story that it's just something that I haven't heard people talk about is Phil Hamilt winning his 15th and 16th bracelet because there's this weird similarity, but I think I'm the first one to notice that before he won his 15th bracelet, he got a lot of hate and criticism online because he was like talking out of turn in a big pot in the main event with an amateur, and he basically gave away that he's going to fold in a three-way pot. So another player called lightly, and people got really mad at him on Twitter. And in a few days later, I think he won his 15th bracelet. And now in 2021, people got mad at him because he snapped at Anthony Zeno. He said, like, I'm going to burn the Rio down or something like that. So people again got really mad at him. And again, I think 6 days later, he won his 15th bracelet. So that's kind of a weird coincidence that for his last two bracelets, he had to, like, come back from this big negativity, big, like, public outcry over his behavior. And both times, within days, he won a bracelet.
Well, Phil has had considerable publicity about his behavior for a long time.
Yeah, that's why I would think that people would get used to it by now and not make a big fuss about it. But those times, like, I remember for the 2018 one when he spoke out of turn and basically told the other players, I'm going to fold, even though it was a three-way pot. He said, like, oh, I heard that when people were watching the main event and when they saw me bust, they cheered, which is a pretty big reaction. Like, he said he almost cried when he heard that. And then he came back from that. But I know that he's known to blow up, but I think both times were kind of like, that's why he got a big response, negative response from the general, like, online poker community, because he kind of went a little bit further than he usually does. And in both times, he got a bracelet out of it.
Yeah, but one doesn't really have anything to do with the other.
Yeah, it's just a kind of a coincidence.
All right. We are talking with Martin Magyar about his new book, The 50 Greatest Stories in Poker History. We're going to take a commercial break, and then we'll be back with Martin. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning at least 99%. This is more such games than anyone else has. For the entire month of December, earn one commemorative bottle of City Light Shine Moonshine per day for $1,000 coin in run through the machine. From December 13th to 23rd, virtually everything in the casino is half price when you use your points. Food, rooms, show tickets, bingo, bowling, liquor store, etc. You do not have to earn the points in December. Merely have them in your account. For the 4 days, December 20th to 23rd, there will be a hot seat promotion every day between 8 a.m. and midnight. Every 3 minutes, one lucky player with a card inserted will earn $100 in free play.
Hey, this is Colin from Blackjack Apprenticeship, and if you're serious about card counting, I'm sure Bob and Richard would agree that there are three things every advantage player needs to succeed. You need to gain the edge over the house, you need to manage your bankroll, and you need to get the hours in at the casinos. After a decade of playing professionally and running teams, I wanted to create the exact training, tools, and community I wished I had had for myself and my Blackjack teams, so we created the Blackjack Apprenticeship membership. Our membership will help you perfect your game, manage your bankroll, and you'll join a supportive community of like-minded card counters and APs. Find out more at blackjackapprenticeship.com.
VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the game. The game of the week is Ultimate X Wheel Poker, one of the many offerings in the Ultimate X franchise. In this game, you bet 10 coins per line and an awarded bonus says this hand to be played off next hand. The difference is that instead of the 12X being the multiplier you earn for a full house, as you do in regular Ultimate X, you spin a wheel. On the wheel are amounts of coins, 250, 500, 1,000, and 2,000, and several slots giving you big multipliers for the next hand, between 14X and 20X. If you earn a multiplier, you get the normal pay for a full house, maybe 45, times whatever multiplier you already have. If you earn a point bonus, you get the normal pay for a full house, times the existing multiplier, and then the bonus times the existing multiplier. As in regular Ultimate X, in the Deuces Wild variations, it's a straight flush that triggers the big bonus rather than the full house. You'll require a different strategy for this game compared to regular Ultimate X, as the multipliers for full house are bumped up and other things are lowered. In most Ultimate X versions, 5X games, 5 play returns more than triple play. This is not always the case in this version. All right, we are back talking to Martin Magyar about his book, The 50 Greatest Stories in Poker History. Are you planning another book, Martin?
Right now, kind of, I have it in the back of my mind, but I'm not actively writing it. I'm kind of thinking about doing something about the ethics and moral philosophy of gambling. If I have to write another book, I think that's what I would do, because I don't think there's enough out there on that subject, and it would help a lot with gambling legislation where it's still kind of strict. In Hungary, it's still kind of strict, especially online. So I don't think there is enough of this type of writing, really examining the ethics of gambling and why is it moral, what kind of gambling isn't moral. So I would write about that.
So this would kind of be a philosophy book, sort of, and not a history book.
Yeah, I would probably need to get somebody more qualified to help, because, I did study some philosophy during my BA studies, but I don't have a degree in that. But I just think that it's like a gap in the market, or in the gap, not necessarily the market, but it's just something that I think we're lacking right now, like real like philosophical look of gambling, because there are a lot of people, like conservative thinkers, just assume that it's an immoral thing. But there's a not really, I know, because I know like Sheldon Adelson, a big like Republican donor, for example, he was a big casino owner too. But there's, let's say, in the religious thought around the world, more conservative thought is usually against gambling, and it not necessarily should be. Like, there isn't really, I don't think there's something inherently evil about betting on cards and trying to play a good card game. So I would write something about that.
One of our former guests is writing exactly a book like that. Bob Wachtel. Yeah, backgammon player. And yep, that's exactly what he's writing about.
And Bob actually does have a PhD in philosophy from Ivy League school. So
he's the better one.
And well, he's been a world-class gambler in the backgammon, which is a small niche. But the cheating in poker and the cheating in backgammon there's overlap, of course, but they're not the same.
I know Phil Ivey got in trouble for edge sorting. That's one of the stories in my book.
But most of our audience would not consider that cheating, so.
Oh, I wouldn't then either. I don't have a strong opinion on that. I kind of see both sides of the coin there, but if it's not, it's not.
Now, there have been a lot of movies with poker scenes in them. It seems like for a poker historian, which is what you are, at least for this book you published, writing a book about the best poker scenes in popular movies. You could easily come up with the 40 greatest such scenes. Is that of any interest to you, or?
Well, now that the philosophy one is taken, then.
Oh, well, there's room for more than one book about any subject. Certainly, yeah. There are thousands of poker books out there. And there's a lot of overlap between them. So, and Bob Wachtel writing in about backgammon and you writing about poker, I don't know that many people would see those in competition at all.
So about the movies, that would be more up my alley because my minor was actually in film theory and film history when I was doing my BA, and also was a finalist in a screenwriting competition when I was 19 in Hungary. So that would be more fit. I'm a little bit more qualified to do that. I would certainly think about it. Yeah, there are some poker movies in this book, in this Greatest Stories book, because poker movies are ultimately poker stories, even if they're fiction. There's one chapter about the Rounders, and there's one about the Casino Royale, the 2006 the James Bond movie, so there would be some overlap, but it's certainly a good idea. I would have to talk to Anthony and Deke about it, the people at Huntington Press.
Yes, if they're not going to publish it, then you don't want to spend time writing it, that's for sure.
Well, actually, for your writing gig, you could just start a periodic column of, and make it a column. And then once you've written 30 or 40 of them, you can just collect them into a book.
Yeah, then I would have to talk to the people at So Much Poker about that. And I'm doing a column about poker videos. It's just poker videos of the week, whatever is popular on YouTube. We could think about something about poker movies of the week or something like that. Sure.
If our listeners want to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Well, my Twitter handle is at mmagyar, M-A-G-Y-A-R, poker, I believe. I'm not that active on Twitter, so I actually have to look that up. I think, it's mmagyar poker on Twitter. That's probably the best way. I don't think I'm going to give out my email address because actually I had my school account hacked once, so ever since then I'm pretty paranoid about stuff like that. So, but my Twitter handle is at mmagyar, mmagyar poker. That's my Twitter.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Thank you. So either just send me a message or tweet at me, and I'll see that for sure.
Very good. Okay, we are going to end up this interview with Martin, and we're going to do our normal recommended. with Richard and I, and Martin has one he wants to recommend. And then since we're not through with a full hour, we're going to fill up the last few minutes with Bob and Richard answers their mailbag. So starting with the recommended, Richard, do you have something?
Poker book, because we were talking about the story of Andy Beal. There is a great book about that whole story called The Professor, the Banker, and the Suicide King. And really interesting book by Michael Craig. He has been on our show, so we'll link to the episode that he was on and link to the book. But very well-written book and a great story.
Yes, I agree. My recommended is a novel, The Vig, by John Lescroart. This is the second novel in the Dismas Hardy series by Lescroart and was written about 1990. Somehow I missed it back then, and I'm enjoying the chance to catch up. As many gamblers know, Vig refers to the money bookies or sports books charge in order for you to place your bets. Betting 11 to 10 means you're paying a 10% VIG on your bet. In this book, the mob is involved, and the VIG is 10% a week, enforced by big, strong, ruthless men. Not fun. The story begins with Hardy, a former cop, former lawyer, now a bartender, being visited by Rusty Ingram, a former co-worker of Hardy's, when they both worked at the district attorney's office. One guy they put away, Lewis Baker, promises to kill them both when he gets out of San Quentin, which is happening tomorrow. Hardy and Ingram agree to call each other every day, so if no call is made, the other guy has a chance to get out of Dodge to avoid Baker's revenge. Ingram never calls. And when Hardy visits Ingram's houseboat to check on him, there's a dead, naked woman there with some blood spots on the bed where somebody has been shot. The blood leads to a path to the edge of the boat. All right, it goes on from there. It's a satisfying detective thriller where by the end, all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed.
Before we go to Martin, I just want to give a second recommend, which is also for a book called The Vig by Peter Alson, who was a guest on our show. So we will also link to both those books, and I'll put a link in also for the episode with Peter Alson.
So we have never had a double Vig show before. So right. this is the first. So, Martin, do you have and a recommended for our audience?
Yeah, it's called checkthesite.com. It's a new poker coaching, poker strategy site founded by two Hungarian guys, but it's all in English. And it's quite different from most other because it's like a community feedback-based strategy tool. So whatever people used to do in the 2+2 forum and all that, when people post handy stories and they want community feedback, did I play this right? Did I play this wrong? So now it's all organized into a nice layout where you can just find every hand by a click of a button, and you can see the feedback and you can give feedback. And it's kind of, they're going for something other than just people uploading videos and his voice and commentary over it. So it's something rather new.
And what is the name of the site again?
CheckThisSide.com. Check this side.
Check this side.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Martin. We enjoyed having you on the show, and we wish you success with your new book, The 50 Greatest Poker Stories in History.
Thank you. I enjoyed being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so we're now going to have some Bob and Richard answer their mail questions. One question is, I enjoy playing video poker, jacks are better, on the 1 cent 100 play video poker machines. This results in play of $1 per spin, and I find this an exciting platform, although hitting a royal on a penny bet would never result in a hand pay. Tempted to play a single hand video poker in the same amount per spin to me has as much excitement as watching paint dry. What, if anything, am I giving up by playing 100 play over the single play, keeping in mind that the amount bet is the same? Okay. Now, the examples you give indicate you're only playing one coin per hand. If you play this way, you're giving up about 1.25% over playing 5 coins a hand. You're far better off with the same pay schedule to bet one hand of 5 quarters for $1.25 rather than playing 1 coin for dollars. In addition, typically penny machines are set 2 to 3% tighter than dollar machines. The general rule of thumb is that every decrement for the full house or flush costs the player about 1.1%, because the frequency of these hands is about once in 90 hands. As an example, a 9-6 game returns 99.5% when you play 5 coins, but an 8-5 game returns 97.3%. Ignore these numbers at your peril. Next question. I'll be going on my first cruise in a couple months. I would like to know if the rules for blackjack are good, average, or lousy. I mean, in general, I understand that each ship may have different games. Richard, do you have anything about this?
You know what? I don't have a clue. I really don't know. Sorry.
And I was just on a cruise ship. And I didn't even look at the blackjack games. It's simply not in my casino wheelhouse. There have been a number of guests on the show in the past who've indicated particular cruise lines have different games or casino bonuses or not. Some ships look for card counters to bar, others ignore them. You'll just have to see when you get there. Next question. Do you see an end of slot hustling being a viable career? It just seems too simple to last. What do you think would make it no longer viable if it does go that way? Oversaturation? Richard, do you have any comment there?
Yeah. So I started playing blackjack in 1977, and every year since then, I hear people say blackjack is dead. You're not going to be able to make a living at it anymore. It's no good. It's over. And it, you know, keeps getting better and better. The game changes. It's different. The approach to making money has changed, but there are still people making 6 figures a year counting cards playing blackjack. So I believe that making money at slots is here to stay. Those games are very, very popular with the public, so I don't think they'll be taking them away. You know, some places have started throwing out slot players. I think you'll see more of that. Competition is fierce in some markets, so that's going to make it more difficult. But I think playing slots for a living is here to stay. Maybe more so than table games, because 10 years from now, I don't think you'll see table games being dealt from live dealers. And you probably won't be able to play in cash anymore. So there may be a brighter future for slots than there is for table game players.
Yeah, I don't know that Richard's example of, since blackjack has been good for 50 years, this will be too. I know video poker was much, much, much better 30 years ago than it is today. It still exists. There are still professional players. But as casinos understand what it takes to become a good video poker player, which probably partly my fault, then they change the situation so that it is not so profitable. So I think the same thing is going to occur with advantage slots. A casino can make money on a slot machine, but they have no edge at all off of the people who play advantage slots. And this will annoy the casinos. They are going to complain to the slot machine designers, and they will not have as exploitable games in the future, is what my crystal ball tells me.
Yeah, I'll disagree. Let me push back on that. With video poker, they have a very easy solution, which is to just change the pay table and make the game worse for you. With these slots, they're very popular with the public. And when the professional wins the money on the slot he's playing, he's not really taking money from the house. It's money that has been held in escrow for the players and is going to be returned to the players. So, I mean, they can increase the hold, but that doesn't mean that there aren't still going to be advantageous situations for the players on those machines.
Okay. Question for me. Which video poker has the least variance? Is it single line, triple play, five play, 10 play, or 100 play? Also, when are you releasing Sex Lies and Video Poker 3, triple play?
Menage a trois.
For the same size total bet, the more lines you play yields the lower variance. That is, penny 100 play is a much smoother ride than dollar single line. For the same denomination, multiple line games have a higher variance than single line games, but not proportionally so. That is, a 10 play game requires less than twice the bankroll to safely play than a single line game. Keep in mind that in addition to variance, EV is important. In many casinos, multi-line games have a lower return than the single-line games. Playing a 99.5% game with a higher variance is a much better, in my opinion, than a 97% game with a lower variance. Insofar as Sex Lies and Video Poker 3 triple play goes, thanks for the title suggestion. It's definitely not a good idea for you to hold your breath waiting for it to come out.
You know, on a related note, I had a question from the Blackjack Discord, which, you know, has been holding readings from Sex Lies and Video Poker, and they wanted to know if you would come on as a guest reader and do a reading from Sex Lies and Video Poker on the Discord.
Sure. So right now I've never been on Discord, and we can talk about that. But I, wow.
You didn't know you have a cult following, Bob.
I didn't, and some of that is some of that book is rather juicy. I assume they don't want me talking about why this video poker machine is better than that video poker machine. There was a lot of that in the book as well. But
Just like teenagers, they want to skip to the good parts, I think.
The ones where they bend down the corn edges of it. All right. So yeah, we can talk about that. Should we advertise on the air when I'm going to do that? I may regret this. All right, last question for Richard. On a recent show, he said he wouldn't date anyone who works at a casino. Now, my answer to that is the easy answer is that Richard is married. But assuming the question concerns the time before he was married, Richard, why wouldn't you date someone who worked at a casino?
Well, as a professional, I had to lie to them, right? I can't tell them what I do. I cannot tell you. I know at least 4, 5, 6 people who dated someone who worked in a casino. The relationship didn't work out, and then that the person they were dating turned them in. I think the whole MIT team got busted one time in that way, where the disgruntled ex called the Griffin agency and said, hey, the whole team is coming to town on this date. You know, I know a number of stories like that. So for me, I couldn't be in a relationship with somebody where I'm lying to them. I remember going on a date with someone and saying, you know, I have to tell you, my name's not Bob, and I'm not a real estate developer from Arizona. So that is why I would not date someone who works in a casino. But your mileage may vary.
Huh. Very good. And so we actually have a little more time. The next question is, have you ever thought of creating a video poker variant and marketing it to a company like IGT? If so, can you briefly talk about the process involved in coming up with an idea that is exciting to the average gambler and devising a pay schedule that has a house edge that is reasonable for both the casinos and the players? And my answer is I have tried, but I've not been successful at getting the games to market. For company like IGT to even talk to you, you need to have a patent. They introduce maybe 8 to 10 years a game, and companies like videopoker.com will have half of them. There are other game designers who will also have 2 or 3 of the possible 8, and IGT has its own employees who are trying to produce games. The route I tried, unsuccessfully, is to go through videopoker.com. I've had a relationship with the top people there for more than 20 years, and I have a big name in video poker, so it's easy for me to get an audience with videopoker.com than it would be easier for most of the listeners to do so. Even with those advantages, they weren't too excited by any of my good ideas. So explaining to you why my ideas were great and why they thought they sucked, probably not something that's going to do you any good. Okay, the next last question for Richard. Someone just purchased CVCX and was surprised to see when running simulations, KO is on par with high-low, and in some cases performs marginally better than high-low. And he presents an argument, a data with a particular game and a particular spread, and KO is a little bit better. So the question is, why is KO seen as an inferior or novice system and looked down upon? Richard.
I don't know that it is. First of all, if you were surprised by that, it means you didn't read the book, because in the book that is discussed. And yeah, and I don't think that it's looked down on at all. I mean, you have James Grosjean recommending it as the count he thinks new counters should use, and it's the count he uses. And if it's good enough for him, I think it's good enough for anybody. Not that he spent much time counting cards, but still. No, it's a very, very good, solid, strong count, and much easier to use. I can't tell you how many people I know claim that they can play 2 and 3 level counts, and they've been doing it so long, they do it perfectly, and color me skeptical. I don't, I find it difficult to believe. And I think James has a blog post about this, and we will link to it in the show notes. But anyway, it's a perfectly good count. And for someone starting out, if they ask me what count to learn, I used to always say high-low, but now I think I would tell them to use KO.
And if somebody knew KO, you wouldn't recommend they switch to high-low just because it's the industry standard?
No, I mean, unless they're joining a team where you're passing the count information or something like that. But no, I there's nothing wrong with KO.
Very good. So thank you, Richard. We got a couple questions in there, and we still have a few left for next time, but we're always in need for more. Send your questions to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or to Richard or me individually. So thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.